I'm Anne-Marie Minhall, and I was manning the fort in the Culture Club this week. It was a very busy show today, where I had the pleasure of chatting to the chef, John Turode, the cricketer, James Anderson, and the actress, Emily Watson. Now, next week sees the opening of Everest, a film inspired by incredible events surrounding an attempt to reach the summit of the world's highest mountain. This is an extraordinary journey of two expeditions which took place back in 1996. And with me this afternoon on the Culture Club is Emily Watson, who plays Helen Wilton, the base camp manager. First of all, you're very welcome back to Classic FM, Emily.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
This is really a story of human endurance battling against the elements, isn't it, at its core?
Yes, absolutely. Man pitted against the mountain, and the mountain wins. Really, but although there are extraordinary and amazing stories of survival within that, you know, human frailty, human courage, and I think it's a very moving film, but it's also really thrilling. I mean, it's a kind of white knuckle ride, particularly if you see it in 3D. You go up the mountain with them, and you experience how scary it is, really, to do that.
As you say, there are lots of individual stories within the film, the characters of the people who took part in that climb in 96, differing backgrounds as well. And it seems all the characters had very different reasons for wanting to climb, which is a really fascinating part of the story.
That's really one of the interesting things about the film, I think, is why do people do it? And they're not all kind of gung-ho, adventurous, outdoorsy types at all. There's some really introverted, philosophical type natures in there. But they all have, to me, they have a kind of something missing. And they have that, you know, a baby is born with a survival reflex, which is, you know, from millions of years of evolution, that's why we've survived, because if something bad happens, we run. But these people, when you climb Everest, you get above a certain altitude and your body is basically dying. You have a small window of opportunity to get to the top and back before it shuts down and you're done. And why you would choose to do that, particularly when you have loved ones and responsibilities, kind of beats me. But I'm glad that people do it. I think they are amazing. And within this group, there's some really, you know, really heroic leaders. I mean, there's the guy who perished, the leader of the group who perishes on the mountain, is a man of great integrity and responsibility, and basically sacrifices his life to try and save somebody else. And tragically, his wife, who's played by Keira Knightley, is home pregnant at the time. And this, what made this event famous, is that they managed to patch him through via a radio contact to his wife, and he was able to say goodbye to her as he was dying at the top of Everest. And all of that event was taped, and it's unbelievably poignant. So there's that kind of story going on in the middle of this massive, great, big kind of Hollywood adventure, you know, sitting on the edge of your seat kind of movie.
This is the Culture Club on Classic FM. We're talking to Emily Watson about the new film called Everest. This is music by John Williams from a film that Emily was in a few years back. It's called The Book Thief, and from it, this is called Learning to Write. Music by John Williams here on Classic FM. It's called Learning to Write from The Book Thief, and John Williams was conducting his very own studio orchestra. Emily Watson is with me this afternoon. We're talking about Everest, which opens this coming Friday. We've been talking about the character that you play, Helen Wilton. That must have been an extraordinary experience to get the opportunity to talk to her. And I wondered, as an actor, is it a different sort of challenge taking on the role of an actual person as opposed to a fictional one?
Very different, yeah. I mean, comes with a great sense of responsibility, and particularly in a movie like this, because the events and everything that happened on the mountain is contested. There's been lots of different books written about on this subject, and everybody has a slightly different version, and there's been a bit of finger-pointing, and people have been very upset by claims made in different books. So all the actors, you know, that big group of kind of silverback gorillas in that room, it wasn't fisticuffs, but it was quite heated about, well, you know, it says in this book that so-and-so did this, and if you do that, then you're going to imply that, you know, it was, there was a lot of quite heated debate, because everybody has a real sense of integrity and a loyalty to serving, you know, the true story of what happened, and a responsibility to the survivors and to the families of those who didn't survive. But after, at the end of the day, you have to kind of let go of that go a bit. I was in the very privileged position that Helen, I spoke to Helen and we talked about it quite a lot, but she, everything that, the, all the radio contact on the mountain was taped, and we listened to those tapes. And we listened, I only listened once to that phone call, because that's, you know, she's never played that to anyone. And it was the first time she, you know, they'd, any of them had listened to it in 16 years. Devastating to hear, but so powerful as an actor. It was like being there. It was an incredible resource, really.
Visually, it's a spectacular film, and we were talking earlier about, you really have to see this film in 3D, don't
yeah,
you? You
have to see it. Absolutely do. I think as a portrait of the mountain, I mean, obviously I've never been up there, but I've spoken to climbers who have and say it is amazing. And although a lot of it they had, obviously, above a certain point, they had to, you know, they climbed in the Dolomites for Everest, some of it. They trekked quite a lot in Nepal. They did film in Nepal quite a bit. But beyond a certain point, there is quite a lot of digital work. But all those digital pieces are based on real shots taken by David Brashears, who is one of the producers of the movie. He's a very experienced climber. He's summited Everest many times. And he was there. He was on the mountain on the day this happened and was part of the rescue. So he's been very involved in putting the film together. So all the digital work is based on actual shots of the mountain. So it feels incredibly real.
And there's an extraordinary scene. We won't give too much away, with a helicopter trying to be part of the rescue.
Basically, a helicopter can't... There's not enough oxygen in the air for a helicopter to get traction on the blades, but they go anyway.
It's well worth seeing.
You might have to hide behind the seat.
Yeah, and we won't even go into climbing across crevices on ladders in 3D with a sheer drop below you. It's a stunning watch. Everest opens on Friday. Before we talk to Emily a little bit about some movie music for which Everest has been scored by Dario Marinelli, a real Classic FM favourite, let's hear music from another of your films now. This is Gosford Park, composed by Patrick Doyle. Patrick Doyle's music, and it's from Gosford Park, from his new album, Solo Piano, and it was Patrick performing his own work. This is the Culture Club on Classic FM, talking to Emily Watson about all things Everest, which opens on Friday, an amazing film based on true events. And Emily, looking through your catalogue of films that you've been in, an extraordinary amount, and just a couple of weeks ago we had one of your co-stars from Everest, Jake Gyllenhaal, in, and he, it turns out, is a massive fan of movie music, and he was talking about how, for him, you know, if there was no music in movies, the impact of so many of the drama would be lost. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, for you, in terms of movie music, you know, what your thoughts are.
Well, I think that if you get it right, the music can be like a character in the film. You know, it can really support the story, and it can access an emotional field in the audience in a way that other things can't. Get it wrong, and it can be cloying and overdone and over emotional, or jarring. So, I mean, it's a very, very difficult thing to get right. But when it is right, it's immensely memorable. And, you know, we live in an age of great film composers. I mean, I've been in three different movies that John Williams has done the music for, and had him write a theme for my character, which really is amazing. He did Angela's Ashes, and he did The Book Thief, and he did War Horse. And just sort of, you know, it's like he has the film, he has a film muscle in his music. It's I mean, it's really a privilege to have been in that position. I think it's a very, very powerful thing. I mean, I've made a film about music. I did Hillary and Jackie about the cellist Jacqueline Dupre, and I spent a lot of time with her music, and it's just, to me, that gave me a real insight into how music kind of shortcuts your brain somehow. You don't have to explain anything or articulate anything to be utterly consumed and transported in the same way I guess other arts as well, but it's very different from the bit of artistic spectrum that I occupy, which is everything is articulated and it's to do with your thoughts and your words and your mind. And that was, you know, it's something I got really blown away by, I guess.
I mean, sometimes perhaps things don't need an explanation in terms of someone like Jacqueline Dupre today, you know, on Classic FM, you know, we play her version of the Elgar Cello Concerto because no one has ever come close to it. And you sort of think, well, it sort of defies explanation. How do you explain why her version is different and in a different sphere to anything that's come since?
I don't know. She just had a channel open. She had a lot of filters missing, and she was just able to enter it in a way. I mean, she'd been playing it from quite a young age, and it just, and in a way, it sort of opened her up. There's something about cello music that is, they say it's the closest sound to the human heart in some way.
To the human voice.
To the human voice. Okay. And it really does cut through in a way. It cuts into you in some way. And the Elgar is very much in that vein.
Emily, thank you so much for taking some time out to talk to us this afternoon. Everest opens on the 18th of September. Take the 3D glasses, take your courage, and an extraordinary watch. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This afternoon, I'm delighted to welcome back to Classic FM John Turode, and his new book is out now. It's called My Kind of Food, Recipes I Love to Cook at Home. John, I want to take you right back to start, if that's okay, and ask you what started to get you curious about being in the kitchen and about cooking, and what got you interested initially?
People ask me a question like this, and I don't really know. I don't know. It just happened. I think it sort of just came naturally. But my mother passed away when I was very, very young, when I was four, and myself and my two brothers moved in with my nana, my grandmother, because my father had to work to try and provide for us. So he lived 1,000 miles away in Melbourne while we lived in rural New South Wales. And but my nana my nana's house had a combustion stove, and that combustion stove really was the centre of the home in the fact that it had to be lit every single morning. Without it, there was no hot water, but it was this massive, beautiful, big piece of machinery, and on it she made everything and she cooked everything, and there was always meringues inside the warming oven, there was always breadcrumbs drying somewhere, there was always something sitting above it, there was, you know, toast being made on a fork in the fire, and I used to sit and watch her all the time, and I would help her. And I suppose that's sort of where it all came from. And then I do remember one Christmas being really eager to help her out. So I made gravy with her, and she taught me how to make chicken gravy. And then I got paid $1 to do the washing up for the 20 people who came for Christmas lunch, which was pretty extraordinary, really. But that Christmas lunch, I can still smell that food. And I must have been 6 years old. And I know that we had a piece of pork, we had a leg of lamb, we had two chickens, and that was between all of those people. And we only ate chicken at Christmas and Easter because chicken was really expensive. So, you know, I suppose that's where it really started from. But she taught me some of the basics, you know, how to make a scone, how to make pikelets, how to make jam, how to grill a lamb chop, how to fry an egg, how to boil an egg. And I suppose that's, but, you know, I was a six-year-old boy who I suppose was, you know, sitting there, you know, looking for a matriarchal figure. And that's what I did.
How did you progress from there then, in terms of, did you have a defining moment? Was there a road to Damascus time when you thought, okay, actually, this is going to be a big part of my life, this is going to be my career path?
Well, in Australia, tertiary education in my era was only taken up if you were going to be a lawyer or a doctor. And I was intending upon being a vet, but then for some reason or other, I just decided to take a Saturday job, and I was washing dishes in a restaurant. And I've always worked, you know, from the age of sort of 13 or 14, I always had a weekend job. I started washing dishes, and then the guy said to me, you know, come and help out on a Saturday afternoon. I'd help out on a Saturday afternoon. And I did that for about a year and a half. And then one day he said to me, look, you know, we want to take on an apprentice. And would you like to become an apprentice? I've never really sort of made a conscious decision to cook. I love it. I suppose it's like a musician, isn't it? Who you know, as a kid played the piano, and then as they grow up, they continue to play the piano, and then they started writing music, and it just happens. I don't know. You know, it's like I was listening to an interview about Sam Smith writing the theme tune to the Bond film, and said that he just, you know, 20 minutes and he just did it. You know, and I think what an extraordinary talent. But I'm fortunate in the fact that I'm really good at food, and it happens, and I can pick up a few ingredients and I put them together, and it works. So for me, that's my music. That's my language.
We're going to talk more about that, John, in just a moment. First, here's a little burst of Handel, a man who loved his food. And this is part of his Concerto Grosso in C. Collegium Musicum 90 playing Handel, the opening to his Concerto Grosso in C, Simon Standage. John Terode is with me this afternoon. John, you were talking there about similarities between music and cooking. And I remember last time you were in here at Classic FM, you talked about when people are starting out in the kitchen and can be a little bit nervous, it's a bit like learning to play the piano, because you don't sit at a keyboard and expect to play Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 as your first lesson. And you think it's the same in the kitchen, that you start out learning the basics and then move on from there.
I think it's the only way to do it. And I think that this is one of the things that I think many of the cooks in the world at the moment are missing out on, and that is the basics. You know, you can't play a piano without understanding the scales. You just can't do it. It doesn't work. And, you know, you got to know your basic chords, don't you? And I think food's the same. And it fascinates me the amount of people I know who've got through life and literally can't boil an egg. And I find it really extraordinary. And, you know, they you know, in my job of MasterChef, I watch people who come in and they are trying to do something which they don't necessarily, I think, believe in. And I think food's got to come from your heart as much as from your head. But what I do want people to do when they pick up my book is to make the recipes their own. In the same way as that if you do sit at a piano and you play a piece of music, you put your own nuances on it, you change little bits and pieces, and you put your heart in it, and you feel it, and you play it just slightly differently. I want people to do the same with my recipes. I'd like people to take them, I'd like them to cook it once, and then decide the bits they really like about it, and then add things to it or take things away and make that recipe themselves. Scribble all over the pages. Use the book. Do you know what I mean? I really, that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see it, you know, well thumbed. And I like the book, you know, the book has started off at a certain size. I'd like it to see it, you know, grown in size because it's been used so much. And that for me would be, you know, a proud moment.
I love a stained cookery book because it shows that it's being used on a regular basis. Going into the book, you talk about these are the sort of recipes that you cook at home. Travel has also played, or continues to play, an important part in what you like to create.
Yeah, I love traveling, and I love being inspired, and I love meeting new people and understanding food. I've just recently been to Malaysia, and I've always said you can't understand the way people cook and eat unless you understand their culture. And Malaysia is an extraordinary culture where there are three groups of people who are living very, very happily together. The Chinese, the Malaysians, and the Indians. And they keep their own religions. They keep their own ceremonies. They do everything. But they literally live side by side. But the food that is born out of that culture is quite extraordinary. And you do have the classic Chinese, classic Malay, and classic Indian. But you also then have this amazing fusion that comes together. And I find that fascinating. It's like America. I think American food is really cool. I think a lot of people think it's not very cool. I think it's really cool. It's not very good for you, but it's really cool. But at the same time, you know, Malaysian food, Thai food, you know, the food of Portugal, the food of Italy. And I love that we have these cultures with different types of food and different styles of food. And I think you're allowed to pick your own thing. And it's the same. I go back to music. I think music is very, very similar to food. In the fact that some people like pop, some people like rock, some people like heavy metal, some people like punk, some people like classic. You're allowed to like what you like. And I don't. And I think this world is becoming a little bit food snob-like. And I think it's time for us to say, no. I don't like that, so I'm not going to cook it and I'm not going to eat it.
We've got a nice wide variety of bases covered in the book as well, John, in terms of we've got stuff from Aussie brunches to, I haven't really got a great deal of time, but I can whip this up quickly to, there's a big family feast going on. So did you set out to sort of think, okay, this is what I enjoy cooking at home, and make sure that we try to cover as many different areas, because we all have different times for food in our lives, whether it's a Sunday lunch or whether it's getting home from work on a Wednesday evening. So you've got to make sure that people have enough choice of what they want to cook.
Yeah, what I actually did was, and really be honest with you, is that I'd never really written these recipes down before. Because I just cook at home. I don't write them down. I don't have them. And I said to my publisher, I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll send you a list of stuff that I cook. And I send her a list of 150 things, which I do quite normal, and, you know, bits and pieces and here and there. And she just went through it and said, I want that, and that. And actually, for a balance, I need one more recipe, which includes, you know, a vegetarian dish, or one more that needs chicken, or one more that probably needs beef. And then that was it. And then I had to sit down and write every recipe out, because I'd never written them down before. Which is extraordinary. And it's great to do it, because then you suddenly realise that you've got this world of yours which you live in, which you've never sort of done. And that's why I've done it.
We're going to talk puds in just a moment. First, here's Sanson's take on it. This is Wedding Cake on Classic FM. A slice of wedding cake, the musical variety from Saint-Saëns. Stephen Hough was our pianist, and Zachary Oramo conducting the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. John, I want to ask you, I know obviously you're a fantastic chef. I want to ask what kind of cook you are at home in terms of tidiness. Do you tidy as you go along, or is it just everything out and then we'll put it all away at the end?
No, I do my own washing up. And I clean up myself and I do everything myself. So I try and stay as tidy as I possibly can. And I try not to use very much stuff. I'm pretty fastidious, and I always have a towel over my shoulder. Always have a towel over my shoulder. It's just something I have. And I always, you know, wipe my hands, wipe the bench with it, whatever it might be. But no, I clean up as I go. I do a sort of chefy world where I prepare stuff, and I'll bring my ingredients out and I put them out in front of me. And then I'll make something, and then I'll put them all away. And then I'll sort of move to the next step. But I prepare, then I cook. That's how I work, rather than, you know, just jumping into it.
We've got plenty of puds in the book as well.
Yeah, plenty of puds, because I think they're a really important part of life.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the other thing that's really important about puds is there should be lots left over. So the next day when you open up the fridge, there's something to eat. Or, you know, the kids can, you know, tuck into it when they get home. And that's why in there's quite a few cakes. The last recipe in the book is dedicated to my nana, who taught me how to cook, because it's about peaches. And as a kid growing up in Australia, we had fruit trees in the garden. And one of the things I remember is a young boy was climbing the trees and grabbing the peaches, and her poaching peaches, and they were just delicious.
Congratulations on the continued triumph that is MasterChef. Why do you think it continues to be such a success, John?
I think because people love food. I think there's a couple of things in the world that, you know, you have to do. One of them is you got to eat. And I think that people also like to be challenged. And the people who come on MasterChef, the contestants, are the people who make the program. It's not Greg and I just narrate it for you. And it realistically, I suppose, we're spoons for hire. And if, you know, all we do really is taste the food and then tell you what we think about it. And that's all we can do, and it's our own opinions. The great thing about MasterChef, we're not scripted. We're not told what to say. Greg and I live very, very different lives from each other. We don't hang out with each other. We've never been to each other's house. We don't socialise, so we have completely different opinions. We eat in different style restaurants. We dress very, very differently from each other. And some think that's good, some think that's bad. I've got hair, he doesn't. And, you know, I think that, you know, those sort of things make the difference. And that's why I think it's a great success.
John, every success with the book. It's called My Kind of Food, Recipes I Love to Cook at Home. John Troyd, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This is The Culture Club on Classic FM with me, Anne Riemann-Hall. It is an absolute joy to welcome to Classic FM the Lancashire and England bowler, the country's all-time leading wicket taker, and one of the most skillful fast bowlers in the world, James Anderson. And James, what a summer of cricket it's been, and particularly if, like me, you're an England fan, it has been an extraordinary summer. We've got lots to talk about, but let's start with the Ashes. How was it for you?
It was great. Yeah, what a summer it was. I mean, you know, we went into the series as underdogs. Not a lot of people thought we had a chance, really, and it was great to get the win and get the Ashes back. Obviously, after a disappointing winter, losing 5-0 in Australia, it was a fantastic turnaround. And obviously I missed the last two with injury, but I was there to watch the games, and it was actually quite nice to be a fan as well for a couple of weeks. So it was a great summer.
May I share something with you? Because on the Culture Club earlier this year, before the Ashes started, we were lucky enough to have Freddie Flintoff in. And I asked him what his prediction was in terms of how he thought the Ashes series was going to go. And here's what he said.
I think we win this series 2-3-1. I desperately hope we will, because I keep telling everyone. But I look at the side, England, and we've got some of the best ever players who have played for England in that side. In Anderson, Cook, Bell. Butler's going to be amazing. Joe Root's great. So it's all going to be good, I think.
Pretty accurate, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm impressed. Like I said before, there's not many people that actually backed us before the series. And I think it's nice when, you know, we did speak to a few former players and some guys that are now in the media before the series. And they were wishing as well and saying we had a good chance. So that it's always nice when you hear ex-players getting behind the team.
And particularly a fellow Lancashire player as well, how did it all start out for you? Was it a passion at school to begin with?
I didn't actually play at school. Football and rugby were the main sports at my school. So I was fortunate that my dad played for the local club and he took me down there from a very early age. And I just got into it through that. And I've always had a love for sport. I actually grew up wanting to be Boris Becker, which didn't work out for me. But I'm delighted with the way things have gone. And cricket is such an amazing game, and I feel very fortunate to have made a career out of it.
I read that you said that what you need in abundance, particularly in international cricket, the thing that can set you out from the rest of the pack, really, your character and your mental strength.
Yeah, well, I think once you make the step up from county cricket to international cricket, that's usually the biggest difference and usually how people stay in the international arena for a long time is the actual mental toughness that you need. And I think it's something that I've improved certainly in the last few years. It's something that I've become better at and become stronger. And actually, I feel a lot like my confidence has built a lot in the last sort of 5 or 6 years. When I first started out, I was always unsure whether I was actually good enough to be there. So it does take a bit of time to get that self-belief.
And looking ahead to Pakistan, it would be a really confident, vibrant England to take Pakistan on.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough series for us because the conditions there will be alien to us in the Emirates. So it's something that we'll have to overcome. We've got an exciting group of players that have got the talent to win over there. So if we can show the same sort of energy and sort of same sort of will to win that we've shown in the summer, I think we've got a good chance.
Well, we are going to hear another piece of music now by another composer who loved his cricket, and he lost his sight towards the end of his life, and he used to get a very good friend of his to come and read him the reports from the England-Australia Ashes series when he was around in the 30s and 40s and read him every report and get him up to date. And a Yorkshireman, something in common with Joe Root. This is Delius's Sunset. To play it, it's pianist John Lenehan and Julian Lloyd-Webber. Delius, lovely tune called Sunset, played by the cellist Julian Lloyd-Webber, and at the keyboard it was John Lenehan. James Anderson is my guest here on the Culture Club on Classic FM. And am I right in believing that, like your test captain Alastair Cook, you were once a choir boy, James?
Not to the level that Alastair was, no. I was in the choir at school. It's something that I enjoyed from a young age, and I didn't go on to the heights that Alistair did, but yeah, it was very enjoyable.
You love your music, don't you?
I do, yeah. I think music's a really big part of my life, and it's a big part of cricket as well. I think the way that it triggers memories in your head, and you know, I'll remember all the songs that I had in my head as I'm bowling for most wickets. So it's something that I feel that it's very important.
Let's talk about wine. You have many offshoots to your career and life outside cricket, fashion and modelling being two of them, and now wine and a wine collection that you launched earlier this year. How did that come about?
I got approached by company in the south of England to maybe do a project together to release a wine. It's snowballed from there. I did a couple of blind tastings, and it turned out that all the wine that I liked was from the same region that the wine comes from.
Tell us about the numbers collection, because the bottles that you've brought out are numbered, but these are numbers that all have significant meanings for you and your cricket career. So enlighten us.
Well, I was trying to come up with names for the wine and finding it very difficult. And I just thought with numbers being such a huge part of cricket and statistics and things like that, I thought it'd be quite apt to choose some numbers that are relevant to me and my career, and use them to name the bottles. So I've got 81, which is my highest score. That's the red. 54 is the rosé, which is an unusual one, a record for the most innings without a nought or a duck, which I'm very proud of. And number 11 is the white, which is the number that I've taken very fondly to batting at.
And is it something that you've, as you say, you know, you kind of got approached about it, but it sounds like you have taken on the project with, you know, as much commitment as you would anything else in your career, kind of researching and making sure you're part of it from the beginning.
Definitely, yeah. I think it's really good to have things that can distract you from your job and the game. Sometimes you need to get away from it and relax, and I've found it, you know, really exciting to do, and really it's taken me away from cricket and something completely different for me, but something that I've really enjoyed. And yeah, I just hope I can get the opportunity to carry on doing it, you know, for the next few years, and maybe when I finish playing as well.
And just finally, I need to ask you a little bit about any superstitions, because I was reading recently about Stuart Broad and obsession with the number 3 that he has. Yeah, he ties his laces 3 times, and he bowls 3 warm-up bowls before doing and marks his space 3 times. So, and a lot of classical composers had huge superstitions, as indeed do some musicians. And I wondered whether you don't have to say, but if you've got any that you like to stick to routine before you go to a big match.
The dressing room is riddled with superstition. There's just everyone has got their own little quirks and things that they like to do. For me, if I have a good day, then I'll try and do everything exactly the same as I did it in preparation for that particular day. So I'll wear the same clothes, get out of bed the same side, etc., etc. Take the same route to the ground. It is one of those things that, you know, I've had many throughout my career, but you kind of I've tried to get rid of as many as possible, because sometimes it's not good to have your mind taken up with worrying about your superstitions.
Well, once again, huge congratulations to you and the rest of the England squad on winning the Ashes, and the best of British for the Pakistan tour as well. Thank you so much, James.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for downloading the Culture Club podcast. Charlotte Green will be back this coming Sunday afternoon at 3 on Classic FM, where her guests will include Sir Carl Jenkins.